A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been thinking about our macro pad conversation, specifically the reset button, and how it reloads the bootloader. And that got him spiraling into the deeper question of what bootloaders actually are, what we even mean by firmware, and this wild thing he came across about OnePlus physically destroying part of a phone's board to make rooting irreversible. He's asking about the essential distinction between firmware and software, across the micro scale and the larger computer scale, from an ESP32 board all the way up to a BIOS versus an operating system. So really, what are we talking about when we say firmware, and why is it walled off from everything else?
By the way, DeepSeek V4 Pro is writing our script today. So hello to our synthetic friend in the cloud. Hope you're rendering this at a comfortable temperature.
I'm sure it appreciates the sentiment. Now, before we get into OnePlus shorting physical traces on a board, which is genuinely one of the most aggressive things I've heard a manufacturer do, I think we need to start with the thing Daniel's really circling around. There's this layer that lives between hardware and what we think of as software, and it's designed so you can't touch it. Sometimes it's literally burned into silicon.
And that's the key word, burned. Let's start with what a bootloader actually is, because most people hear the term and think it's just some utility that loads your operating system. It's way more fundamental than that. On almost every computing device, when power hits the chip, the processor doesn't know what an operating system is. It doesn't know what a file is. It wakes up with its program counter pointed at a specific memory address, and it starts executing whatever's there. That first thing it finds, that's the bootloader. On an ESP32, which Daniel mentioned, it's actually a multi-stage process. The very first stage is in mask ROM, which is literally hard-coded into the silicon during manufacturing. You cannot change it, you cannot erase it, it's physically part of the chip die.
Mask ROM. That's the thing where the data is laid down as physical patterns in the metal layers during fabrication, right? It's not something you flash, it's something that exists as a geometric fact about the chip.
The ones and zeros are actual physical structures. And that first stage bootloader in the ESP32's mask ROM, it's tiny, about 4 kilobytes. And its entire job is to check a few strapping pins, figure out where to find the second stage bootloader, load it, verify it, and jump to it. The second stage is what Espressif actually ships as their bootloader binary, and that lives in Flash. That's the one you can update. And that second stage then loads your application firmware. So already, on what Daniel called a very basic device, you've got three layers before your code even runs.
None of that is the operating system. That's the thing that trips people up. They think bootloader equals BIOS, and BIOS loads Windows. But the bootloader concept is fractal. It repeats at every scale. Your phone has a bootloader that loads another bootloader that loads the kernel. Your Wi-Fi chip has its own bootloader. The microcontroller in your keyboard has a bootloader. The reset button Daniel was talking about. When you press that on an ESP32 dev board, it pulls a pin low that tells the mask ROM bootloader to enter download mode instead of jumping to the application. So the recovery mechanism isn't some software trick. It's built into the one piece of code that physically cannot be bricked.
This is where the term firmware starts to make sense. It's not just a marketing word. Firmware occupies this position on the spectrum between hardware and software. It's softer than hardware because you can update it, but it's firmer than application software because it's not something you casually mess with. The bootloader is the firmest firmware. On a modern Android phone, the boot chain is a stack of cryptographic checks. The primary bootloader, which is in the CPU's internal ROM, verifies the signature on the secondary bootloader. That secondary bootloader verifies the trusted execution environment, the modem firmware, and then hands off to Android's boot image. Each link in the chain checks the next one. And if any check fails, the device halts.
Which brings us to OnePlus. Daniel said this blew his mind, and honestly, it's one of the most aggressive anti-consumer mechanisms I've seen. What OnePlus did. And specifically, this was on certain devices like the OnePlus 3 and 3T, and then it evolved on later models. Is they implemented something called anti-robot protection using e-fuses?
Let's explain what those are, because the name is misleading. They're not fuses in the sense of a glass tube with a wire inside. An e-fuse is a tiny circuit on the silicon die itself, essentially a one-time programmable memory cell. When you blow an e-fuse, you're applying a voltage spike that physically alters the semiconductor material. It creates a permanent conductive path through what used to be an insulator. After that, the bit is permanently changed from 0 to 1, and there is no mechanism to change it back. It's a one-way, irreversible, physical modification of the chip.
It's not software at all. It's a physical state change.
It's metallurgical. You're literally burning a microscopic wire into existence. And here's what OnePlus did with it. Every time you update the firmware on one of these phones, the bootloader checks a version number burned into the eFuse array. If the firmware you're trying to install has a version number lower than what's in the fuses, the bootloader refuses to load it. You cannot downgrade. And if you try to force a downgrade by flashing an older bootloader, the system detects the mismatch and bricks itself.
Daniel mentioned something even more extreme than that. He said the phone will short something physical on the board that can never be recovered. And I think what he's referring to is a step beyond e-fuses. There were reports, and this got a lot of discussion on XDA developers, that some OnePlus devices had what amounted to a self-destruct mechanism for the bootloader unlocking path. If you tried to tamper with the secure boot chain, the system would deliberately blow an e-fuse that permanently disabled the bootloader unlock capability. Not just relocked, permanently disabled. The phone would still boot, but you could never, ever unlock the bootloader again. The path was physically severed.
That's different from just bricking the device. Bricking means it won't boot at all. This is more insidious. The phone works fine, but you've lost a capability forever. The e-fuse that controlled the unlock flag is blown, and there's no going back. What makes this so brutal is that it's not a policy decision stored in rewritable flash that the manufacturer could reverse if they wanted to. It's a physical fact about the silicon. Even OnePlus couldn't undo it. They'd have to physically replace the system on chip.
Let's connect this back to Daniel's question about the separation between firmware and software. What we're really talking about is a hierarchy of mutability. At the bottom, you've got mask ROM, immutable by physics. Above that, you've got one-time programmable memory, like e-fuses, mutable exactly once, then immutable forever. Then you've got firmware stored in flash memory, which is rewritable but protected by cryptographic signatures and hardware security mechanisms. Then you've got the operating system, which is fully rewritable but runs in a less privileged mode. And then you've got user applications, which are the softest layer of all.
That's a really good way to frame it. And the hardware enforces this hierarchy. On an ARM processor, which is what's in basically every phone and most embedded devices, there are exception levels. EL3, EL2, EL1, EL0. The secure monitor runs at EL3, the highest privilege. The trusted execution environment runs there. The hypervisor runs at EL2. The operating system kernel at EL1. And user applications at EL0, the least privileged. The bootloader typically runs at EL3 before handing off control. Once it hands off, the lower levels can't reach back up. There's no system call to get back into the bootloader. That's why the reset button works the way it does. It triggers a hardware reset that starts the whole chain over from the mask ROM.
This is where the BIOS versus operating system distinction on PCs gets interesting, because the architecture is different. On a traditional PC, the BIOS, or UEFI, on modern systems isn't running on the main CPU in some separate enclave. It's firmware stored on a flash chip on the motherboard, and when the CPU starts up, it executes it directly. But even there, you've got the same layering. The BIOS initializes the hardware, sets up the memory controller, enumerates PCI devices, and then hands off to the bootloader, which hands off to the operating system. And once the OS is running, the BIOS is mostly dormant. The OS can call into it through ACPI for power management and things like that, but it can't rewrite it without going through a specific flashing process.
UEFI added a whole new layer to this. Modern UEFI firmware has its own network stack, its own file system drivers, its own graphical interface. You can browse the web from your UEFI setup screen if you really want to. It's practically a mini operating system. And that's where the line between firmware and software gets blurry. Is UEFI firmware or is it an operating system? It runs before the OS. It's stored in flash on the motherboard. You update it through a special process. It quacks like firmware. But it's got more features than some actual operating systems I've used.
I remember when UEFI first shipped and people were alarmed by how complex it was. The attack surface exploded. You've got a full TCP/IP stack running in the most privileged context on the machine before any security software has loaded. And if you compromise the UEFI, you own the machine permanently. The OS can't detect you because you're underneath it. That's what made the LoJack and Computrace controversy so interesting. Those were UEFI modules that could survive a complete disk wipe and OS reinstall.
Computrace, or LoJack for laptops as it was branded, was originally an anti-theft system. It embedded an agent in the UEFI firmware that would phone home on boot. But the mechanism it used, writing a module into the UEFI flash, is exactly the same mechanism that a rootkit would use. And the truly terrifying thing is, even if you wiped the hard drive entirely, even if you replaced the hard drive, the UEFI module would still be there. It would reinstall its Windows agent from the firmware on every fresh install. That is what firmware persistence means. It's not just surviving a reboot, it's surviving a complete OS replacement.
That brings us back to Daniel's question about the ESP32, and even a very basic device. The ESP32 has no UEFI, no BIOS in the PC sense, but it has the same fundamental architecture. The mask ROM bootloader is untouchable. The flash where your application lives is separate, and there's a hardware mechanism, the strapping pins, that determines whether the chip boots normally or enters download mode. You can't override that from software. If your application crashes in a way that leaves the chip unresponsive, you pull GPIO 0 low, hit reset, and the mask ROM bootloader takes over. It's a hardware escape hatch.
That escape hatch is what makes development possible. Without it, one bad firmware flash turns your device into a paperweight. But here's the thing. Manufacturers are increasingly closing those escape hatches on consumer devices. The OnePlus eFuse mechanism is the extreme example, but it's part of a broader trend. Google's Titan M security chip in Pixel phones, Apple's Secure Enclave. These are separate processors with their own firmware that the main OS can't touch. They run their own boot sequence, verify the main processor's firmware, and if something doesn't check out, they refuse to release the decryption keys. Your phone might boot, but all your data is gone because the keys never materialized.
Let's pull on that thread. Daniel asked about the essential distinction between firmware and software. I think the distinction is ultimately about who controls the update mechanism. Software is something you, the user, can replace at will. You can install a different operating system, a different browser, a different text editor. Firmware is something the manufacturer controls. Even if you can update it, you can only install updates the manufacturer assigned. The update mechanism is gated by cryptographic keys that you don't have, and in the most extreme cases, like mask ROM and eFuses, you can't update it at all.
That's the practical distinction. But there's a technical one too, and it's about what the code is allowed to do. Firmware runs at a higher privilege level than the operating system. It has access to hardware registers the OS can't touch. It can configure memory protection, set up the interrupt controller, initialize peripherals. The OS operates within the sandbox the firmware created for it. And on modern systems, there's an even deeper layer, the secure world. ARM's TrustZone splits the processor into two virtual cores, a secure world and a non-secure world. The non-secure world runs Android or Linux. The secure world runs a tiny, audited operating system that handles cryptographic operations and key storage. The non-secure world can't even see the secure world's memory. They're physically isolated by hardware.
When Daniel talks about the bootloader being on a separate part of the chip, in its own enclave, that's literally true on a lot of modern silicon. The secure world has its own RAM, its own flash, its own peripherals. The main CPU literally has wires that only the secure world can access. And the bootloader is the gatekeeper that sets all this up before anyone else gets to run.
Let's make this concrete with the Android Verified Boot process, because it's a beautiful example of how all these layers interact. When you press the power button on a modern Android phone, the CPU's internal ROM, the mask ROM equivalent, loads a tiny bootloader that's signed by the chip manufacturer. That bootloader verifies the next stage, which is stored in flash on the device. That next stage is the Android bootloader, often called A-boot on Qualcomm devices or the bootloader partition. A boot then verifies the boot image, which contains the Linux kernel and the initial RAM disk. The kernel verifies the system partition using DMVerity, which checks every block against a hash tree rooted in the verified boot image. And all of this is anchored in a root of trust that's physically embedded in the hardware, either in mask ROM or in one-time programmable fuses.
If any link in that chain is broken, the device either refuses to boot or boots in a degraded state. On a Pixel, if you unlock the bootloader, the device warns you on every boot that the OS can't be verified. If you relock it with a custom OS, it'll brick because the signatures don't match. And if you try to downgrade to an older version with known vulnerabilities, the anti-rollback mechanism, those e-fuses we talked about, will stop you.
Which is actually a security feature, not just a control mechanism. Anti-rollback prevents an attacker who steals your phone from downgrading the OS to a version with a known exploit. If you're on the November security patch and someone tries to flash the October version to use a vulnerability patched in November, the bootloader checks the eFuse counter and refuses. That's good security. The OnePlus situation is where it gets ethically murky because they use the same mechanism to prevent users from voluntarily downgrading or unlocking the bootloader. The mechanism is neutral. Fuses don't care about your intentions, but the policy encoded in the bootloader determines whether it protects you or restricts you.
Daniel specifically asked about OnePlus making it so you can't go backwards, and there's a philosophical question embedded in that. When you buy a device, do you own the firmware? Do you have the right to replace it with something else? The manufacturers say no. They're selling you the hardware and licensing the firmware. You don't own the code that makes the device work. You own the atoms. But the atoms are useless without the code. So what have you actually bought?
This is the right to repair and right to tinker argument applied to software. And it's why projects like Lineage OS exist, and why the modding community fights so hard to unlock bootloaders. When a manufacturer blows an eFuse that permanently disables bootloader unlocking, they're not just making a technical decision. They're making a statement about who ultimately controls the device, and they're making it irreversible. You can't sue them and get your unlock back. The atoms have been permanently rearranged.
Let's zoom out to the larger computer scale, because Daniel asked about BIOS versus operating system too. On a PC, the situation is different, and in some ways it's more open, and in some ways it's worse. The UEFI firmware on a PC is stored on a serial peripheral interface flash chip on the motherboard. It's physically accessible. If you have a hardware programmer, a little clip that attaches to the SPI chip, you can read it, write it, erase it, regardless of what the firmware wants. The hardware gives you physical access. On a phone, the eMMC or UFS storage and the SoC are all soldered together, and the boot ROM is inside the SoC. You can't clip onto it. Physical access doesn't get you the same level of control.
That's a really important distinction. On a PC, the firmware is stored on a discrete chip that you can physically interact with. That's why CoreBoot and LibreBoot exist. People can replace the factory UEFI with open source firmware because they can physically flash the chip. On a phone, the boot ROM is inside the same silicon as the CPU. There's no external bus you can tap into. The only way to interact with it is through the protocols the manufacturer designed. And if those protocols require signed firmware, you're locked out.
This gets to the heart of what firmware is, at least in my view. Firmware is code that runs on hardware you can't physically access or modify. It's sealed inside the chip package. You interact with it through the interfaces it exposes, and if it doesn't expose an interface for what you want to do, you're out of luck. The ESP32 is actually unusually open in this regard. Expressif documents the bootloader, provides the source, and lets you replace it. The mask ROM is sealed, but it's minimal and well understood, and everything above it is yours to modify. That's why the maker community loves the ESP32. It's a device where the firmware-software boundary is explicitly designed to be permeable.
Compare that to a modern iPhone. The boot ROM, called iBoot in Apple's terminology, is in mask ROM on the A-series chip. It's never been publicly extracted. There's an entire industry of security researchers and jailbreak developers trying to find vulnerabilities in iBoot because that's the only way to gain code execution at that level. And Apple patches those vulnerabilities aggressively because iBoot is the root of trust. If you control iBoot, you control everything above it, the kernel, the OS, the encrypted user data. That's why an iBoot exploit is worth millions of dollars on the vulnerability market.
The ESP32's mask ROM is 4 kilobytes, and its job is to check a pin and load the next stage. iBoot is probably a few hundred kilobytes, and it implements a full cryptographic verification chain, USB device firmware, update recovery, and a bunch of other stuff. The complexity difference is enormous, and complexity is the enemy of security. But it's also the enemy of user control. Every feature in the boot ROM is a feature you can't change and can't opt out of.
Let's talk about the reset button again, because Daniel mentioned it as an easy recovery mechanism, and I think there's something profound there. The reset button works because somewhere, at the very bottom of the stack, there's code that runs before anything else, and that code is designed to be simple enough that it can't fail. On an ESP32, the mask ROM bootloader has one job, check a pin, decide whether to boot normally or enter download mode. It doesn't have a file system, it doesn't have drivers, it doesn't have an updater. It's so simple that there's almost nothing to go wrong. And that simplicity is what makes it reliable. That's the philosophy behind good firmware design. The lower you go in the stack, the simpler and more auditable the code should be.
That's the opposite of what we see in practice. UEFI is not simple. It's a multi-megabyte code base with network stacks and file system drivers and graphical interfaces. Every line of code in the firmware is a potential vulnerability, and it runs at the highest privilege level. That's why projects like Corboot exist. They strip the firmware down to the bare minimum needed to initialize the hardware and hand off to a payload. Corboot itself doesn't even load an operating system. It loads a payload like CBIOS or a Linux kernel directly. The idea is to minimize the amount of code that runs in that hyper-privileged context.
This connects to a broader principle in systems design. The trusted computing base. The set of code that, if compromised, compromises the entire system, should be as small as possible. On a modern smartphone, the trusted computing base includes the boot ROM, the bootloader, the secure world operating system, and the kernel. That's millions of lines of code. Every one of those lines is a potential vulnerability, and because they run in the secure world or at kernel privilege, a vulnerability there gives the attacker complete control. The firmware is the most sensitive part of the trusted computing base because it's the least visible and the hardest to update.
Let's circle back to Daniel's original framing. He said, we're really talking about the essential distinction between firmware and software. And I think after all this, the distinction comes down to three things. First, privilege. Firmware runs at a higher privilege level than the OS and applications. Second, mutability. Firmware is harder to change than software, and in the extreme cases like mask ROM and e-fuses, it's physically impossible to change. Third, and maybe most importantly, visibility. You can inspect your operating system. You can list processes, check file hashes, monitor network connections. The firmware is opaque. It runs before your monitoring tools. It hides in secure enclaves, and you can't audit it without specialized hardware and expertise.
That third point is the one that keeps security researchers up at night. There's a class of malware called firmware implants, or sometimes bootkits, that infect the UEFI or the bootloader. Once installed, they're invisible to the operating system. Your antivirus can scan every file on your hard drive and find nothing, because the malware isn't on the hard drive. It's in the SPI flash chip. It loads before the OS, it hooks into the OS boot process, and it can hide itself from anything running in the OS. The only way to detect it is to read the firmware directly with external hardware and compare it to a known good image.
This is why the integrity of the firmware supply chain matters so much. When you buy a motherboard or a phone, you're trusting that the firmware it ships with hasn't been tampered with. You're trusting the manufacturer's signing keys haven't been compromised. You're trusting that the update mechanism is secure. All of that trust is placed in code you can't see, running at a privilege level you can't access, on hardware you can't physically probe. It's the ultimate black box.
Let's tie this all together with something concrete. Daniel mentioned rooting Android. When you root an Android phone, what you're actually doing is gaining root access, super user privileges, in the operating system. But root access in Android is not the same as full control of the device. Root gives you control of the non-secure world. It does not give you control of the secure world, the bootloader, or the firmware. Those run at higher privilege levels. So even a rooted phone has layers of code that the user can't touch. And on devices with locked bootloaders and blown e-fuses, rooting might be the best you can do, but it's not full ownership.
Full ownership would mean replacing the bootloader, the secure world OS, and the kernel with code you trust. That's what projects like GrapheneOS and Postmarket OS are trying to do. But they can only do it on devices where the bootloader can be unlocked, and manufacturers are making that harder and harder. The OnePlus eFuse mechanism is the logical endpoint of that trend, a device that physically self-destructs its unlock capability. It's a one-way ratchet toward lockdown.
There's an irony here. The same mechanisms that protect you from attackers also protect the manufacturer from you. Verified boot prevents malware from persisting across factory resets, which is good for security. But it also prevents you from installing an alternative operating system. The eFuse anti-rollback prevents an attacker from exploiting old vulnerabilities, but it also prevents you from downgrading to a version that had an unlockable bootloader. The security and the control are implemented by the same hardware using the same mechanisms. You can't have one without the other.
That's the fundamental tension, and I think it's what Daniel was getting at with his question. There's this layer, firmware, that sits between us and our devices. It's necessary. It's powerful, and it's increasingly designed to be beyond our reach. The reset button on a dev board is a reminder that it doesn't have to be that way. You can design firmware that's simple, auditable, and user-controlled. But the economic incentives push in the opposite direction. Manufacturers want control over the devices they sell, and firmware is the most effective control point.
Where does this leave us? If you're a developer or a tinkerer, buy devices that let you control the firmware. The ESP32 is great for that. The Raspberry Pi is great for that. In the phone world, Google Pixels are the most unlockable mainstream devices, and Fairphone makes a point of supporting alternative operating systems. If you're a regular user, understand that the firmware on your devices is a black box that you have to trust. Keep it updated, because firmware updates fix real vulnerabilities. And if you're somewhere in between, someone who cares about this stuff but isn't going to flash core boot onto their laptop, at least be aware that the boundary between firmware and software is not just a technical distinction. It's a boundary of control.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The mantis shrimp has 16 color-receptive cones in its eyes. Humans have 3. It can see ultraviolet, infrared, and polarized light, and it can punch with the acceleration of a .22-caliber bullet.
Oh, right.
That's going to stay with me in a way I'm not entirely comfortable with.
Is the forward-looking question I keep coming back to. We're seeing a trend toward deeper firmware lock-in across the industry. Apple's moving Macs to Apple Silicon with sealed boot ROMs. Qualcomm's adding more security features to Snapdragon chips that also happen to restrict user control. Cars have dozens of microcontrollers with signed firmware. The Internet of Things is a nightmare of unupdatable firmware with known vulnerabilities. Is there a countertrend? Is anyone building devices where the firmware is open by design, not just open by accident of a forgotten debug pin?
I think the countertrend is in the RISC-V ecosystem. RISC-V is an open instruction set architecture, and because there's no single company controlling it, the entire stack can be open. There are RISC-V systems on-chip being designed now where the boot ROM is open source, the secure enclave is open source, and the firmware is auditable. It's early days, and the performance isn't competitive with ARM or x86 yet, but the architecture is there. Whether it gets traction before the lockdown model becomes universal is an open question.
That's the hope, anyway. Thanks to Daniel for the prompt. This one spiraled in exactly the right way. Thanks to Hilbert Flumingtop for producing, and for that deeply unsettling fact about mantis shrimp. This has been My Weird Prompts. Find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
We'll be back soon. Try not to think about the firmware in your devices. It's probably fine.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.